own hometown, Justice David Prosser. So with those introductions made, I will now call our second case today, our fifth in Appleton, 00-1570-CR, State v. David C. Polacek. Nyla J. Robinson will be arguing for David C. Polacek. She'll have 25 minutes. Sandra L. Nowak will argue 30 minutes for the state of Wisconsin. She's an assistant attorney general. And then Nyla Robinson has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Robinson.
Thank you. May it please the court. We are here to discuss the tensions, I think, between the obligations and the duties of persons who are charged with reporting suspected child abuse, and in this case happen to be the employees of a school district, as well as the duties of other employees of that school district, for example, the administrators, who are charged with responsibilities to the public, including relations with parents, as well as staffs and teachers. And in that group of obligations that they have is that of communication. One of the things that parents can ask is that they have access to reports related to child abuse suspected involving their children. The one stricture is that names of reporters may not be identified, nor information provided that would identify the reporter. And we have a very narrow issue, I think, and that is whether or not the statute that governs this conduct, governs the confidentiality of reports, requires that no repetition of the content of the report can ever be made, or merely that the content may not be disclosed in the sense that it may not be revealed or made public if it was previously secret. The dictionary meaning of the word disclose is not at issue. There is, I believe, agreement by all parties that it means to reveal a secret, to tell that which was not previously known. It is undisputed for the facts in this case that Mr. Polacek wrote a letter to parents in which those names appeared. There is no question, according to the statements attributed to Mr. Polacek in the criminal complaint, that he had a copy of the statute and had read it, was familiar with it. The offense with which he is charged is not the most serious criminal offense that can occur in the state of Wisconsin. It is a $1,000 fine and 6-month maximum penalty. All criminal convictions for persons who have previously led a blameless life can be catastrophic, both with regard to the penalty, with regard to the existence of a record, and the collateral consequences, not just community stigma, but other collateral consequences that attend upon a criminal conviction. It should not be treated lightly. There has been a suggestion that this is a strict liability statute as to which there is no significance whether or not Mr. Polacek knew that he was providing information that was indeed previously known or had no idea that that is what he was doing. There is a claim that there is no question here that the prior knowledge is of any relevance. The state's argument as to the reason for why this conduct can be criminal is, if I understand, that the contents of the report related to suspected child abuse is confidential per se, is cloaked with confidentiality via the statute, which indeed refers to the fact that these reports shall be kept confidential. He uses the word shall and refers to the fact that those agencies, institutions maintaining the records and reports shall not disclose them except with the following exceptions. And I refer to one of those, which is the disclosure to parents, absent identity of the reporters. There has been much discussion in the briefs about what sometimes it's been called ludicrous or unworkable consequences might follow if the position of the defense were adopted by this court. It is not, I think, unreasonable to take a look at what would happen in the most extreme circumstances if you rule one way or another. You have a paucity of facts in this case, but you have an overwhelming paucity of law as well. I think the statute is not unambiguous, and I have argued that a plain reading of the language in it and the use of any dictionary known to us involving modern English would lead to the result the defense has urged. I am realistic, however, that the argument has been made that it is ambiguous, that we must look to legislative intent, that we must consider the policy considerations that are involved in any statute governing conduct relating to suspected child abuse. The state urges that if the defense position is adopted, it would be next to impossible to prosecute someone successfully. I will concede that they would have to prove a negative. They would have to prove that the information was not previously known to the recipient. Proving a positive is always easier than proving a negative. It is not impossible to prove negatives. It would require investigation, the gathering of facts, and the presentation of evidence. But that is the business the state is in when it chooses to charge a citizen with a crime.
Well, Mr. Robinson, there are degrees of knowledge and certitude. And an instance like this, it strikes me, maybe the parent, you could, under circumstances such as this, have parents who knew for certain who were the disclosures. On the other hand, Mr. Polishek's letter could have been confirmatory. They didn't know for sure, but they knew. Now, what do you do in a situation like that?
If you're asking what do you do, are you referring to
how does the law?
I think they might question the parents. They might look at the circumstances under which they claim to have become aware of the information. Circumstantial evidence, as well as the direct information from witnesses, and not always friendly witnesses, is characteristic of how crimes are regularly proven. And let me add that I think this statute might have been better drafted than it is. It might have been better drafted if prior knowledge was an affirmative defense. It would both cause a certain amount of caution on the part of people who are making reports, but it might also...
I drafted the statute.
Justice, with all due respect, it may become apparent what the problem is. And that is...
I just didn't want you to get too deep.
I think it's not short of rude. The problem is that the statute, as it is applied here, puts burdens on the state, I think, that are difficult. Proving a negative is hard. Negating the exceptions in an enacting clause can be difficult. And it might have been more easily used by law enforcement if drafted a different way. That becomes apparent after you watch how a statute functions. And no one's seen that with this statute, at least at the appellate level, until very recently.
Ms. Robinson, can I interrupt
yes.
for just a minute? I just want to get clear in my own mind the facts involved here. It's my understanding that the letter goes from the superintendent to the parents.
Yes.
I believe the copies went to the two reporters of the alleged abuse. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did the letter go to anyone else?
I do not believe so. However, I feel that I must be somewhat cautious because there have been issues raised in this case relating to how limited the record is and how clearly I must stay within those lines. I do not know of that having occurred.
All right, let me ask you something else. How did this case develop that there was basically an instructions conference prior to any kind of trial? Was that at the judge's direction? Was that at the request of counsel?
It became apparent that we had an upcoming trial. And at one time, the trial was set much closer to that instruction conference and was moved for reasons unrelated to the instructions. In preparation for that, of course, it became apparent there are no canned instructions, as we call them. We were both charged with turning in what we thought appropriate instruction should be. And I provided an instruction and memorandum. The prosecution provided an instruction. The court said that he liked mine a little better, which is what the letter decision says. I pointed out in the brief that those instructions were substantially identical. And the new trial date approached. Shortly before it, the prosecution prepared a second order, and I objected to there being an order other than something that indicated non-pro-tunk, because I thought the letter decision was an order, was an appealable order, and we were about to have the trial derailed. There was never an instruction conference. We submitted what you have in your appendix, my instruction memorandum, the prosecution's instruction, and the court rendered a decision. None of the issues that are before us today, none of the issues that have been argued in the appellate briefs were ever presented to the trial court judge, which is one of the reasons this record looks a little funny.
Thank you.
My question has to do now. The state is arguing strict liability. That's the position. And the amicus brief, the one by the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, talks about the rule of lenity. I'm going to ask you, what about, how do you fashion, if possible, a good faith defense to the, what I say, the plain reading of this statute? How would you do that?
Meaning, how would one prepare a defense as an attorney? How would one...
If we take, and Justice Crooks indicated where the communications went, we know who they went to, what would be a defensible position?
That the person who provided information, which included names, had received previous information that the persons to whom he was making the communication knew that they... who the reporters were, but that had been evidenced by the way we usually prove things. Circumstance.
That's actual knowledge.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. If the question was, should there be a defense here, mm-hmm. if the person providing the names had reason to believe or constructive information or it looked like they were known, no, I don't think that's good enough. I think that the statute suggests that discloses to tell a secret, the converse is also true. If it wasn't known, it wasn't known. And that would lead to criminal liability.
So that's the scienter here, in a strict liability?
Well, I think that's the debate that's been presented, is whether or not there should be a requirement on the part of the defendant that he know he was not producing, he was not revealing a secret.
You want us to read that into the statute?
I think it is implied by the language in the, first of all, I think it's appropriate. It is the rule and not the exception in statutes that provide criminal liability. Of course, there are statutes that impose criminal liability that are strict liability, but I don't think it is the norm. It's not the historical norm, and it is not the usual case. I don't think it's reading it in the sense of creating it to reach that result.
It's implied in the word disclose?
Yes, it's a conscious act. Disclose, by dictionary meaning, is to take an affirmative act to reveal, to tell a secret.
Well, one of the issues is there a violation when the principal tells the superintendent?
There would be the same violation if the principal does not know this information is provided. If
the superintendent doesn't know, should the principal report this?
Meaning to the superintendent?
Yeah.
If the information is already public by one means or another, I do not think that that was a crime. That is one of the interesting examples of to what extent do you criminalize the repetition of information. Another example would be if a child sat in a room, listened to one school employee talk on the phone to another school employee about whether or not she suspected child abuse, and to a person on the phone, but known to the child. And all those facts and circumstances are disclosed. The secret's told, and he goes home and tells his parent. Do we prosecute the child? He has repeated information which the state would argue can never lose the cloak of confidentiality by any conduct, including that of the reporters.
Who under the statute is entitled to know the name of the reporters? The reporter knows his or her own name, right?
Yes.
Okay. So who does he or she report to?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
The teacher discovers what she or he thinks is child abuse, right? Okay.
Yes.
What does the teacher do with that information?
The teacher, not everyone who works in a school is a mandated reporter, but the teacher is. And the teacher must provide the information to, I think, she may provide it to social services. She may choose to provide it to someone else as part of the conduit of getting it to social services. But the appropriate person is social services.
And to the extent he or she, the teacher, reports it to anyone else, the teacher is revealing her own identity. Is there any problem with that?
I think the state's argument is that the confidentiality cloak can never be lost. It follows the content, doesn't follow the circumstances. I would argue that, yes, confidentiality can be lost in that situation, just as if I have a client that I can't dissuade from bringing two family members into the room, the attorney-client confidentiality is lost, and it's lost by the conduct of the participants. If that is the reporter's conduct, that she speaks in front of other people, including the child that I've posited in that example. I don't think there is anything confidential about that. When an anonymous report gets to social services, there's every reason to treat it as confidential. It started out that way, and it can be maintained. The difference, I think, between the principal difference between the state's position and that of the defense is that the defense is arguing that the content of the report may or may not be confidential based on the circumstances surrounding how it is maintained or how it is preserved in the first place. And therefore, there may be a secret to tell, and there may be no secret at all that exists. The state is arguing that the confidentiality referred to in the first paragraph under confidentiality in the subsection can never be lost, that it follows it. And it leads, I think, to some fairly absurd results. The prosecution of a child that I've just referred to, for that matter, a police officer who writes a report, the district attorney who mails it to a defense lawyer. We reach the point at which the statute is no longer functioning as a protective mechanism for reporters, which is what I think it was designed to do, and that's a laudable goal, but is beginning to function as a gag order that certain things may never be said without regard to how they have been, to whether or not they're public, essentially, and how they've been treated.
Isn't there a difference between the content of the report and the person who files the report initially?
The portion of the statute to which I believe the state's referring, when it starts talking about confidentiality, refers to reports, records, the contents of them, and of course I think that includes the identity. I don't think that the identity is separate from the report.
Counsel, am I understanding correctly that you're positing the only defense to this statute is if you are disseminating information to someone who already knows it, then that's a defense?
Yes.
Is that the only defense?
The question that's in part raised by the Chief Justice's question is whether there are times when the information was never confidential in the first place. But that is, I think, a separate question.
Let's say this was an amicus brief in this case. And it wouldn't be this thick. And it was filed by the ABC Friends of Education. And let's say that brief had in it, in its appendix, you know, someplace clear black back here, the names of the reporters. Is the author of that brief, under your interpretation of the statute, subject to prosecution?
I think it depends on how the information was obtained. There is a point at which I think the information is essentially public, and that may turn on how many people have been told. It is difficult to separate that from the fact situation with which I'm familiar.
It's hard for me to envision a standard of if it's become public. I mean, certainly if it's on the front page of the Post Crescent, that's an easy one, you know. But I'm not sure if it's become public, if other teachers know. I'm not sure if it's become public, if only four teachers know, but two of their spouses also know. So that's a really amorphous standard for me. I'm wondering if this ABC brief had this information in, and I read it, and I said to my law clerk, here, help me work on this case and read this brief. Am I subject to prosecution?
I'm
disseminating information about who reported. Is that your understanding of the statute?
You are repeating, and you are furthering who knows. That I take to be the meaning of dissemination. I don't think you're revealing. I don't think you're disclosing. And no, I don't think you're violating for that reason.
So I can... What's the difference between if I disseminate this information and I disclose it?
Whether or not it was previously known. And I return to something as simple as the dictionary definitions of the two words, which have I think, a grave distinction, great distinction, in that one has a reference to something having been secret. It can be confusing, and it is difficult because we don't have as complete a factual record to use the kinds of examples of the what would happen if. But in the situation I've posited, where the reporter, him or herself, does not protect the confidentiality, makes the phone call under those circumstances, rather than, for example, nodding her head and smiling and saying, yes, Johnny, well, I see how you got those bruises, and then makes a discreet phone call an hour later. We have a very different situation. There is an effort to preserve confidentiality. Once you have a different kind of set of facts, you may lead to the point where the information is essentially public, where it has become known by so many people that the newspaper reader, who may not have known it the day before but does now that it's in the newspaper, is not becoming privy to anything approaching a secret, nor does cessation of information about that subject matter really serve the purpose that I think was intended in this statute, to encourage the reporting of child abuse by persons who have knowledge of it.
Suppose the superintendent spoke to the Oconto Falls paper and somehow the names were divulged to the Oconto Falls paper. Putting the superintendent aside, can the newspaper be prosecuted for publishing the names?
The difficulty with this is that at some point, who is held criminally responsible becomes the important question. And I think that the prosecution should properly fall on the person who tells the secret first. Other people aren't in a position to know that it is a secret. It's not a secret from them. So that in terms of trying to sort out who's the problem, if a social services worker decides to go tell who the reporters were, I think that social services worker has a problem. Someone who's maintaining the record goes and hands the information out. The situation where we go from, for example, a child or a reporter to the principal, to the superintendent, and then the superintendent is talking to someone else, I think you're way past the purpose of the statute. I think you've reached a point at which it would be overbroad. Because of the way the case came up, those issues as well have just never been hashed out at the trial court level and haven't come up with this case.
Could I go back to a question that Justice Babbage asked here? Is the court in a position to create a defense of knowledge on the part of the recipient where the burden is on the defendant to prove that knowledge? I mean, given this statutory scheme, are we able to graft an affirmative defense on the statute or not?
It's tempting to say that the court can do pretty much anything by the way of interpreting statutes once you decide it's ambiguous. And if you reach that point, I think that what you can conclude is that the statute does not require the state to prove prior secrecy. And that essentially does the same thing. Yes, that is one interpretation you could put on this statute. I think the way it's drafted, it really does look like statutes that require the state to prove the absence of exception, would prove the fact that it was previously a secret. And I'll acknowledge very fully, I think that is harder than proving the positive. I think it is a more cumbersome situation than clearly creating the affirmative defense. I don't think the statute currently has, by its language, does not look as if the method of avoiding conviction is to present the evidence of prior knowledge as an affirmative defense.
In addition to asking for an interpretation of the term disclose along the lines that you've suggested in the statute, you're asking us to read in an intent element, a mens rea, as I understand it, to read in the requirement that the state prove not only disclosure within your definition, but an intentional disclosure. Is my understanding correct about your argument?
Yes, that the person who provided the information has done so intentionally, has done so knowingly, because it is a criminal statute that can have very grave consequences for someone.
Where do you find that in the statutes?
I'm out of time, but if you wish to continue,
he does. We do. We're not out of time yet.
Okay. And I wish I were.
Right.
The statute is criminal, and I know I'm repeating myself, but I think that that's the general rule, is that criminal statutes require some level of guilty knowledge and awareness that one is doing a misdeed, whether or not you're formally aware of the wrongfulness of the law. One middle ground, and that's been suggested in one of the briefs, is that the court find a a requirement of a general sort of intent? In other words, that you knew you were disclosing it, that you can't do it by leaving a paper on your desk and someone saw it.
But the statute doesn't use the word intentionally. Subsection, unless I'm misreading the statute, and
it
sometimes
not.
It's hard, the penalty for under sub 6, which refers to people who have to make reports, does use the word intentionally. It says whoever intentionally violates this section may be fined $1,000, etc. But in the section that I think refers to the section that is under at issue today, it says any person who violates this subsection.
It continues to talk about unauthorized disclosure.
Yeah, unauthorized dissemination.
Right. And I think that the difference is that failing to report can occur for any one of a number of reasons. And it punishes, the statute punishes only one who knowingly, presumably has information that would lead one to report and does not do so. And incidentally, that also requires the state to prove a level of knowledge on the part of the individual. In other words, that they had a state of mind, a body of information before them that should have led them to report. So that the word is there, I think, for more than one reason. Of course, knowingly usually disabuses anyone of the belief that this could be a strict liability statute. In the language, in the section that relates to the disclosure, it refers to an unauthorized dissemination of information. It refers to the use of information that is somehow unauthorized. But
it also starts off, though, with any person who violates this subsection. It
yes.
says nothing about intent there. And
no.
then it follows with the word or who permits or encourages.
It refers back, however, to the top of sub 7, 7A, which talks about the reports made, the records maintained, and shall be confidential, may be disclosed only to the following persons. And that's where you pick up the disclosure language again. In other words, the criminal section doesn't really even describe a crime in and of itself. It refers to having broken the rule that is contained in paragraph 7A. At least that's the one that's applicable in this case. And that language talks about disclosure, which I think cannot be, by definition of the word, other than on purpose, because it is telling a secret, revealing. There must be a secret to reveal. One must know there's a secret by implication before you can tell it.
Well, to deal with that, I'm sorry, Justice Crosser, I find a conflict here in the statute. Subsection C that Justice Babbage just referred to makes reference to whoever intentionally violates the section by failing to report. Okay, so it's limited to failing to report, whereas E and F take care of the violation, because F deals certainly just with this subsection, which is a reference to 7.
Yes, whereas 6 refers
so
to
right.
the section, which is a broader body.
But usually, my understanding is that where you have a statute that doesn't show criminal intent, and 939.23 defines various criminal intents, knowing, intentional, etc., that the general rule in the state, and we probably have many cases on this, is that you look to see whether or not the legislature was just forgetful. Because the assumption is, as you stated, that where there is a significant penalty, the general rule is scienter. Otherwise, you've got a due process problem, as I understand it, potentially. And here, you got $1,000 or 6 months. That's a, I mean, there are harsher penalties, but this one is criminal, rather than just a fine or a forfeiture, which would be, the forfeiture would be civil. Do you think this is an unconstitutional provision?
I think that if we were back in the trial court, there are a number of constitutional problems with the statute. The one that I think is most significant today is that someone in Mr. Polishek's position, who owned a copy of the statute and a copy of Webster's Third and used them together, would not come to the conclusion that if he put names in a letter that were already known to the recipient, he was exposing himself to criminal liability. In that situation, yes, I think that there's a constitutional problem.
So if the court would say that disclose doesn't mean what the dictionary says, but anyone that reveals information, whether it's to someone who knows or doesn't know, that is a violation of the statute, is it your position then that it should be prospective only?
I think it would be a very dangerous thing to rewrite the meaning of a word. particularly where it's not a legal word of art, it's a commonly used word in conversation, and one who read the statute would assume they knew it. You're not in a position to write a definition. This definition's at the beginning of the statute. This one was not defined. I also think that it was actually the state who pointed out in its brief that this statutory language used to include the word reveal, arguably a broader term than disclose, and the language was changed. One must assume, I think as justice is looking backwards at the statute, one must assume that that was deliberate. One must assume an informed legislature thinking about what it was going to do when it made that language alteration.
Well, just to follow up on that, and I hate to belabor the point, but I think it's important, apart from the definition of disclosure in this case, the issue of whether this is a strict liability offense, and if so, because it doesn't, as Justice Babich and the Chief Justice have pointed out, because it doesn't say intentionally on the face of it, and by operation of the section from 939 that was just quoted, that gives rise to the assumption that it's a strict liability statute, there are limits on the state's ability to create strict liability statutes, as has been pointed out. And I didn't notice an extensive argument in your brief that this statute falls victim to those limits. Can the state, in this context, in this area, create a strict liability offense that punishes, for example, the accidental or inadvertent disclosure of a reporter's identity?
If one wrote a statute which said, once a child abuse report has been made, any reference to any part of its content or to how it was made ever in the future is a violation, then I think you have, yes, very grave problems with whether you can write that statute. How does one know that the information you're repeating came from such a source?
Well, even in this context, where you have a school superintendent who came into possession of the information that these reports were made, or this report was made by these reporters, and accidentally or inadvertently included the names of the reporters in the letter that he wrote to the parents. But setting aside the issue, the definition of disclosure and whether they had previous knowledge of the identities, etc., just the issue of, can this be a strict liability offense? Can the state criminalize the accidental or inadvertent disclosure? Put somebody in jail for making a mistake?
There are certainly strict liability statutes that criminalize what I would call a mistake. Selling liquor to a minor. I mean, there are certainly situations in which it can occur, but in those settings, the person knows what they're doing. They know they're selling liquor, and they know they're selling liquor on purpose. So that's a different situation. And yes, I think there's a very great problem with criminalizing what is good faith conduct, what is someone communicating with parents around a subject matter that, let us use the situation where the parent isn't absolutely sure. And I do not argue that those are the facts in this case. I argue they are not. When you have the administrator in the position that his inadvertent from the point of view that he did not intend to tell a secret, no, I think it's very difficult to criminalize that behavior. I think it is unjust, and I think it will tend to chill the ability of parents to talk to administrators and administrators to talk to parents, which is a value as well as the concern about reporting. The requirement is this. I think there's a requirement as the statute is drafted that the state must prove as part of this that the administrator in this situation knew he was revealing a secret and knew that it was previously unknown and knew that he was revealing it. And I think that that construction of the statute, while it puts a significant burden on the state, does save the statute from that particular problem.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. Sandra Noah, Assistant Attorney General, Madison, Wisconsin, representing the state.
May it please the court, counsel, I am Assistant Attorney General Sandy Nowak. The statute here is absolutely clear. In enacting this statute, the Wisconsin legislature undertook not only to protect the identities of the individual people, the citizens who stepped forward to make a good faith effort to report child abuse, but the legislature also sought to protect Wisconsin's system of child protection, which relies in part on the willingness of citizens to come forward and make reports of abuse and neglect. The statute is clear on its face when the statute is read in its entirety, as this court will do in efforts of statutory construction. The first part of the statute says that this information is confidential. It is secret as a matter of law. And to address the concerns about the potential for over-application of this statute, the state reminds counsel and the court as well that the state from the beginning has said that this statute applies only to the people who either maintain a report or a record or who receive it pursuant to this statute. In other words, if a school staff member or even a visiting parent overhears a conversation in the school proper, which would happen to disclose the identity of a reporter, there would be no prosecution under this provision for that person who happens to hear it if they receive the information through some means not authorized by statute. That is why it is so important to apply strict liability to the people whom the legislature has entrusted to have this
but
information.
But just so I understand, here the recipients of this letter, at least the parents, is there any question? They had actual knowledge. They knew.
That is a disputed fact. They may have had a strong assumption, and if you consider the situation that a child who is suspected to be abused or neglected, how often is it that a parent could go back and trace either the child's pattern through the day or in interrogating the child find out who the child thinks may have made the report? But actual knowledge is disputed in this case.
Counsel, there are 17 individuals or entities, maybe even more, depending on how you do the count, but at least 17, to whom reports can be made confidentially, right?
That's correct.
And when I read the statute, and I may have missed one or two, but maybe not, there are only 3 people to whom you cannot disclose the identity of the reporter. Is that right?
That's correct.
A child's parent, guardian, or legal custodian, or expectant mother, a child's foster parent, a person with physical custody, and a person engaged in bona fide research, right?
The other would be an attorney acting on behalf of the parent or guardian.
Can or cannot?
Cannot.
The attorney cannot. Okay, I missed that one. So, but those, then you've got 4 out of the 17, roughly.
That's correct.
Now, when I read, and we're under 3M, are we? 7-3M, that this is a disclosure to a child's parent, guardian, or legal custodian?
Yes.
And then it says, except that the person or agency maintaining the record may not disclose any information that would identify the reporter. Does the superintendent maintain the record or report?
I would argue that, yes, they maintain the report. The record would depend, because record is defined statutorily here. It has to be in writing. So that I don't know about. But I believe because of an agency position with his staff, he maintains that report.
Who else maintains that report here? Does the teacher?
Yes.
Does the nurse?
Or, yes.
Does the social service agency?
Yes.
Does the teaching aide?
Without identifying facts specific to this record, anyone, I believe, who makes a report under this statute, yes.
So you want this to read, except any person who makes or even knows about the report, don't you?
No, if they know about the report pursuant to statute, if they're authorized to have that confidential report.
So anyone who's authorized to have the confidential report or has made the report, then they are persons who maintain the report and cannot disclose it.
That's correct.
Because usually when you talk about somebody who maintaining the record report, maybe only one person in this chain.
Well, if the legislature had intended to refer to the custodian of the record, I think they could have. And I think if you look in context with the statute, the legislature has also encouraged agencies to work together and collaborate. And I think that is why the confidentiality provisions of the statute need to be so carefully watched, because I think counsel actually made a great point for the state in that once this information becomes public, we lose control of it. Then you may as well put an article in the paper. And that is where our system of child protection and encouraging people to report child abuse becomes really a grave issue.
So
So under the statute, are you done, Chief?
Mm-hmm.
To follow up the chief's question, let's assume for the moment that the parents did not know who the reporters were, and this was the first time that they received that information. If they were to disclose that to someone else, what I hear you saying is they could not be prosecuted because they are not the maintainers of the record.
That's correct. And they were not lawfully entitled to that information.
If we could consider the realistic factual setting that we find ourselves in here for a moment, this is a school?
Yes.
Right, and the kid shows up at school with this red mark on his forehead, right?
Yes.
And that raises a suspicion, right?
Yes.
And so he's questioned about it by the school official?
There's a limit to how much I can answer your question unless you want me to get into the disputed facts and the confidential facts of the report. I can tell you that those facts are disputed as to who was present when certain information was said to the child.
Part of the reason for my question is to demonstrate the absurdity of all of this when it's taken to extremes. And I think we need to explore some of that in order to properly interpret this statute. I mean, we're in a situation where, you know, these sorts of things happen in real life. They don't happen in the abstract. And reports are made and investigated in dynamic settings, you know, in which conversations may be had in faculty lounges and the school office when school personnel are picking up their mail. Oh, I noticed this mark on so-and-so. You think I ought to do something about it, et cetera. And to what extent do we allow the reach of this statute to go without reaching a level of absurdity? I mean, it reminds me of some of the zero-tolerance policies and ordinances and rules that are on the books that we should be allowed to apply some common sense to this and determine, you know, what's a criminal offense and what's not under this statute.
I have two responses to that. First, the application of common sense, I think, rests in the hands of the prosecutors, local elected officials who have two-year terms. If there may be circumstances where good judgment will tell them, you know, this really isn't a prosecutable offense. In this particular case, I would point out that the criminal complaint reveals that apparently there was a problem in this school district with compliance with mandated reporting. I don't know the details of that, but those might be circumstances where a prosecutor might elect to pursue a criminal prosecution or otherwise a confrontation might be the more appropriate. Other than that, what you've said to me doesn't, in my mind, raise the issue of an absurd result. Remember that this statute applies to a relatively narrow group of people who the legislature has identified as people who, through their profession, will have ongoing contact with children, who are, for the most part, required to make reports, that they understand the implications of these reports. And the application to that narrow group of people, we can't do anything to legislate gossip. Gossip will happen, but for this narrow group of people who are entrusted with information that no one else has, I think strict liability and the just say no rule would apply. I would also point out that in this situation, there was nothing to stop the school administrator from communicating to the parents about either what actions they had taken subsequent to stop, for example, an unsubstantiated report from happening again. May be lower people on the power structure in our communities. They step out. They take a risk of confronting another citizen, a parent, about potential abuse. That's something that our society has recognized as being difficult for people through the years. If that person steps out, is it really right for someone in more power to step out then and basically hang them out to dry?
No, I'm not questioning the wisdom of confidentiality in this context. That's not appropriate for us to do as a court. That's a legislative determination. We have a statute that prescribes a criminal penalty against a very wide swath of potential quote-unquote offenders. I mean, in this context, it's a little hard to even invoke that term, but that is what we've got here. And subjects that wide swath of potential offenders to 6 months in jail for, you argue, on behalf of the state, even the accidental or inadvertent disclosure of the name of someone who reports suspected child abuse. Is that, can the state do that? Can the state criminalize that and put somebody in jail for it?
Yes, we can. I guess I would refer, my favorite language in all the cases that I've reviewed here was in State v. Kolova, which was a traffic-oriented case, and the question was about notice. I think it was failure to insure his car or something. But what they talked about was, is this the standard of care that we would expect someone who is entrusted with this information to have? So even an accidental disclosure, and I cite the example I used in my brief, do I expect... this is one area in the statutes where the person who, people who are subject to this provision, remember, are provided training. The statute requires that these people get training about this information. Is it too much to expect that you're going to be careful with that information that could have very grave consequences for the citizen who stepped forward and assumed their civic responsibility to protect a child? And
I don't know. I just sitting back here listening to the questions of my colleagues, that it sounds a bit Orwellian in what state is seeking here and the responsibility that you're imposing on, as the Chief Justice noted, 17 different categories of possible individuals, and it's and then to top it off with no intent, strict liability, no excuse, that's it. And that is what I think is a bit perplexing or difficult for at least myself and some other members of this court to accept. And so when you say, and no doubt that what you're saying is that's it. It's strict liability. There are no exceptions. And when Justice Sykes talks about common sense, and then you say that, well, the state uses its common sense. That's the prosecutor, the district attorney of that particular county. It's up to he or she to bring this charge. And in their discretion, they use their common sense, and that's it. So that's your argument in, I think, a nutshell, isn't it?
It is, except that I think also you need to recognize, and I should have mentioned this in response to Justice Sykes' question, in that because the statute... this is an issue of statutory construction before this court. When we look at did the legislature intend to impose strict liability, then we go back to the store or stare standards. And under those provisions, it's pretty clear that this is intended to be a strict liability crime. There is no language, even though in the same section of the same statute, there was an intent requirement. What the purpose of the statute is to accomplish a public good, but also to regulate behavior for people who receive training on this very issue.
Is it a fair statement? I just in my notes that to say that the statute imposes the responsibility of confidentiality only to those who legally have access to these records or reports.
That's correct.
Could I ask? This whole incident started, I believe, March 2nd, 1999.
I believe
and,
so.
And the letter that was written, I think, is in June of 1999. Assuming you prevail, will the superintendent be able to tell any of the events, any of the facts of what happened in March 1999? And really his explanation of why he did what he did?
I think part of the answer to that question will depend on the trial court's ruling. If we prevail, the explanation would not be relevant unless he can establish a privilege under 93945. And I believe he could explain to the extent he can without identifying information from that confidential or releasing information from the report or the identities, information that would tend to identify the parties involved. I think there's nothing to stop him, for example, from saying my intention in communicating, if this is true, I don't know, again, the facts are disputed, my intention in communicating information about child abuse reports to parents was an attempt to keep, to maintain the lines of communication. I don't think that that contains any confidential information. I don't think he can say, well, I thought that the, I thought the report was unwise for these specific reasons, and that's why I disclosed the names of the parents, even though I admitted that I didn't need to do that.
It would seem to me there are certain facts that I think I'm discerning from this record, that the person who actually contacted social services had not seen the child, that the school principal who did see the child called social services and said, don't come, this is not child abuse. I think your position you have to take, if you're saying this is a strict liability statute, is none of that is relevant and cannot be introduced. And that, to me, is shocking. I was shocked that the criminal complaint doesn't name any names. It's letters. It's symbols. Is that what our system has come to?
I think, first of all, it has happened in this state before where we've coded victims' names in sexual assault and child sexual assault cases, such that what is required in a criminal complaint is that the defendant knows the identities. There's nothing that requires that the identities be made public. The state's position is that these two citizens who made good faith reports, and it has never been alleged that these reports were made in anything less than good faith, that they, in having their names brought public in violation of the statute, that they are victims. If in a small community like O'Connell Falls, we don't know what the implications of making a child abuse and neglect report are in that community. Historically in this country, and it is a fine balance, I will agree with you, that we always have to be careful whenever the state is intervening within a family's context. That's why the early cases of child abuse and neglect were prosecuted as crimes against animals, because the state is very reluctant to get involved in those situations. And that transfers out to our citizenry. Who am I, the reporter might say, to make a judgment about whether that parent has abused their child? What if in this circumstance this was not the first time, hypothetically, that this child had suffered an injury that seemed to be out of the ordinary? What if, hypothetically, this child was of a class of children who are known to be particularly at risk for child abuse and neglect? Would we want those reporters to say, I'm not going to make the report because I don't want to be viewed as a tattletale, I don't want to be viewed as having used bad judgment? The point is that we don't normally want school superintendents or principals investigating alleged child abuse, that we want those investigations to happen in the hands of the people who are trained to do it, which are law enforcement or child protection.
Well, as I read your brief, I think I contrast what I think the kind of evidence you'd want to exclude with the kind of evidence that you talked about here. Well, this superintendent had a little trouble in the past, and then there's the second incident in here. How can you have it, seems to me, both ways?
You can't.
Well, sure you can. At sentencing, they can raise that. So you get the maximum of 1,000 or you get the maximum of 6 months. What will you do, close the door?
I think that's other acts evidence she'd like to put in there.
Well, and at sentencing, would you just close the courtroom door because it's privileged communication?
From Justice Prosser's raising it at state of conviction, and all of that is gone, according to you. But clearly, you might want to raise it at sentencing. Then what do you do?
And there, I think the legislature has recognized that that may have to happen in giving prosecutors the authority to prosecute this kind of case. The legislature has essentially created that would be where it's relevant. And I would also point out that the information that I said with regard to the school superintendent is part of the criminal complaint.
Are there First Amendment implications to this charge?
Well, I think there always are, but none that could seriously be entertained because of the statute's purpose. And again, this applies only to people who are in specific professions where the legislature has saw fit to impose the obligation
that they maintain reports. That's not true. That is not true. Because I think here you do not have a required reporter as one who actually was involved in a report. And in fact, if I see, Justice Supreme Court is not listed in the statute, but if I have cause to believe, having cause, that there is a, I'm entitled to make a report. Anyone in the audience is.
Yes. And then you are making that report consistent with this statute.
And then they're entitled to confidentiality?
That's correct. They are entitled to it, and the people who are trained about the statutes and their obligations would be required not to disclose the citizens' identities.
What if a reporter is acting in bad faith?
Then I believe that the statute would not apply because the criminal provisions would apply only to reports made under this section.
Well, how do we know whether someone is reporting in bad faith or not?
I think that's a determination for either for law enforcement, child protection, the prosecutor, or I believe if the subjects of the report have a legitimate basis for that belief, they could. That's the other thing about this, is nothing would stop them from going to the court and asking for permission to access the information. And in fact, the statute does not criminalize making a bad faith report, that I believe that would have to be prosecuted as an obstruction.
But a civil suit. Mm-hmm. It seems to me there's discovery, depositions, the whole process. If you're going to never disclose the reporter, how do we know whether the reporter was acting in bad faith or not?
I'm not saying you can never disclose. I'm saying that the court is the body that has the authority to make that determination, not an individual who receives the report. And remember that the parents or the subjects of the report have access to all of the other information. And certainly if there are criminal charges, they have full-scale discovery. But and that may entitle them to a good faith basis to get the information from the court. But I would argue, if I were their attorney, I would argue that if it's not made in good faith, it's not covered by the statute, and therefore there is no confidential protection to the identity of the reporter.
So, as I understand, the letter that the superintendent wrote to the parents addressed the circumstances behind, I don't know how much the record discloses of what was in the letter. Is the letter in the record before us?
The letter is in the record, but it's sealed because it identifies the party.
We could see it, I guess. So it's here?
Yes.
Okay. Is there any information in the record that the disclosure of these names was necessary in any way?
No, and that's in fact in the criminal complaint that the defendant admitted he did not have to, that he could have accomplished his goals in sending the letter without identifying the names.
Now, all of these court proceedings that are listed here and administrative agencies that are entitled to these reports and records, will all those proceedings be closed? Because if it's open, it might be revelation.
You know, I don't know. I think that if they're proceedings here, because they're dealing with a confidential report, they probably will be closed.
And my other question, while you're looking that up, is suppose that there is an error and the trial court proceeding under sub 10 or 10G or 10J, that's accidentally released. Does this statute trump the concept of judicial immunity?
I don't know.
Which we hold dear to our heart.
I'm thinking very, very hard before I answer that question. And I'm afraid I'm not up on judicial immunity, so I really
don't. No, and it won't appear on the
face of it. But I do think that raises a good point, in that strict liability crimes are subject to privileges if there was coercion, for example. So it's not like he's absolutely being
persecuted as well as prosecuted.
That's correct. And again, I think it's easy to look at the situation in this point because it's the facts that you have of the person who released the confidential report. But considering the implications for the people who made that report is critical to an analysis. And I think that that's what the legislature did when it passed the statute in this way.
If there's a substantiated report of child abuse and it's later prosecuted criminally, then disclosure of the identities of the reporters is necessary.
Right, and recognized by the legislature in Chapter 48 as well. I think that also is an interesting point or an important point with regard to what Chief Justice raised earlier in that the only people that the statute says can't know about the identity of the reporters are essentially the parents. And I think you can infer the legislative intent in creating the statute that way. What were they worried about? They were worried about retaliation.
Justice Bradley.
Yes. You indicated that the two bases for strict liability here were, number one, there was no language in the statute and regarding intent, and then the purpose of the statute. We have, a myriad of cases that stand for the premise that in criminal law that scienter is the general rule and that it is to be presumed even absent express reference in the statute. Doesn't that general premise hurt your first argument that no language requires it here?
I am not aware of cases that says that scienter is presumed. I am aware that of the cases that talk about scienter being the rule.
I'm sorry, let me see. I might be wrong. Scienter constitutes the rule in our criminal jurisprudence and is generally presumed even absent express statutory reference.
Okay, I stand corrected, but I also think that specifically all the rules of statutory construction are aimed at getting what the legislature's purpose was. And here, the indication in 48981.6, which imposes an intent requirement, as Chief Justice pointed out earlier, indicates that the legislature recognized they could use the word with intent, but elected not to. And I think you have to read into that, combined with, and I'm not understore, there are a myriad of reasons why this makes sense, that this is a strict liability statute. But I think that in and of itself really is an important.
Well, to follow up on that, though, it's not just an issue of statutory construction. That's where we start.
Right.
To determine whether this is a strict liability offense or not, but that doesn't end the analysis, does it? I mean, there are some limits on the state's ability to create strict liability offenses.
That's correct.
And what are those?
Well.
And do any apply here?
I think there are due process issues. I think there, constitutional concerns that I really, the due process issue that was raised in one of the amicus is clear. I'm really not prepared specifically on anything more than that. But I think the question of a reasonable punishment is addressed in some of the cases.
It's a tough issue because essentially the states can define what it wants as a crime. That's a basic concept in the federal cases, U.S. Supreme Court cases. But there's always a proviso, but farther than, and then there's a little question mark, you can't go, obviously.
Right.
So
but I think
that's the tough part. The food and drug cases, and one of them that you mentioned was a food and drug that had been mentioned, are ones where strict liability has been defined because it's a highly regulated industry, and the dangers to the public health are very high. Here, it seems to be regulated, and the dangers to children are very well known, but you got so many people that we're now in a never-never land, potentially. You may or may not want to concede that, so we can leave it at that, counsel.
If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nowak. Counsel, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. The difficulty with saying we will write the statute this way, or we will interpret the statute this way, and then if there would be absurd results, we will trust the common sense of prosecutors not to charge those cases, is still giving them unwarranted power. It's still creating an injustice.
Can you give me an example of an absurd result?
Yes, and I think I'll return to where I had started, and that is the child who overhears, not accidentally, is sitting in the room next to the phone, mm-hmm. when a discretionary reporter calls a mandated reporter, describes the situation, talks about the whole question of reporting, going to social services, and the child goes home and tells his parent. Under the state's construction of this statute, which is the content is confidential and that never changes, and the mere repetition of the content of the report is criminal. Forget all the disclose and reveal
stuff. Who can get charged in your example?
I think in that example, you can charge the child with delinquency. He has repeated.
But the child is not a keeper of a record under this statute.
No. If the child goes home and tells a parent, parent talks to teachers, parent talks to principal, principal talks to administrator, none of them are keepers of records.
So how is the statute applicable to them? You have to be a keeper of a record in order for the statute to be applicable.
I think that there is certainly disagreement in this room, at least at the council tables, about who's a keeper of a record. If you restrict it...
Well, you would certainly admit that the child is not a keeper of the record.
He is a holder of information, and I believe I heard the argument that one who has obtained the information is, in the first instance, given the same strictures as the keeper.
So you're saying that if the child, first of all, under 7.1, as I read it, reports and records may be disclosed only to the following persons. One, the subject of the report. Is the young boy here the subject of the report?
Yes, but again, there's the restriction about the identify the report.
I understand that, but then you get to E, which says, a person to whom a report or record is disclosed, that's the boy here? Right?
Yes.
May not further disclose it, except to the persons and for the purposes specified in this section. So the one of the people that's specified is the parent. But suppose the child tells it to a fellow student. Right?
Yes.
That's not a person that's authorized to get this information. Can
no.
the child be prosecuted under this statute?
I think as the state is urging you to read it, yes.
Counsel, it seems to me your interpretation of the statute is much broader, because when I talked about this ABC amicus brief, you said there were only two defenses. You know, number one, if it was public already, and number two, if the person already knew the information. But as I hear the state's argument, you know, I'm not going to be prosecuted for giving this to my clerk, and I don't know if you were suggesting I should be or not, but in this kind of an example,
I hope not.
In this kind of example, you only gave two defenses. So it seems like your reading of the statute with regard to those who are subject potentially to criminal prosecution is much broader than that of the state's.
One of the difficulties is that our discussion has really shifted to who's a keeper of the record. That wasn't, in many respects, that was not where we started out in briefs. And that is not well defined. It's not particularly clear. And the difficulty is when the child tells the parent, parent tells the principal, is the principal now a keeper of the record? Because theoretically, I guess a child abuse report might end up, there might be a copy of that in a principal's office. I don't think that knowledge imposes the responsibility of keeping the secret, merely having access to it, if it isn't one. And I think you can get to that result either of a couple of ways. Initially, we talked about the notion of disclosure, telling a secret versus repeating information initially said to be confidential. That could lose its confidential character. You can get to the same place by defining very clearly who is a maintainer or keeper of a report or record, record being written, report being something far broader than that, but not not necessarily extremely well defined. If we limited the keeper of a record or a report to only those persons charged with the responsibility to keep a secret, that is, social services in the first instance and the reporter, we wouldn't be here because Mr. Polishek wouldn't fit that definition. There are there is a great deal of need for some clarification, I think, with regard to how this is to be applied. The court could get to the result the defense is urging by any one of a number of methods. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Robinson. I'm sorry, Justice Glasser.
Can I ask one other question? You want to read an intent requirement into the statute. How do you deal with simply negligence in disclosing records? We can't have people being reckless and negligent with confidential records.
Given the fact that reporters are immune from all civil and criminal liability, and most of the classes of people who might wrongfully hand out information, whether it was reckless or negligent, by mere carelessness, are not. I think there is a civil remedy isn't dealt with in the statute, but that exists. This case, I think, we're having these arguments in the context of a criminal conviction and all of the things that go with a criminal conviction, and I don't think that there should be one for negligence or even for recklessness. A fine, a forfeiture, that simply hasn't been provided for. What it is criminal responsibility or the panoply of other kinds of remedies that exist outside the statute.
Thank you, Ms. Robinson. Thank you, Assistant Attorney General.